My name is Willie, and I am an alcoholic. And that's all right, because that's one of the nicer names that I've been called. Betty's pretty and a real dignified name, so I'll settle for that. Because people have often asked me, you know, is this short for Wilma or Wilhelmina? And no, my father named me Willie after his older brother, and that's that. So it is my real name. It's not a nickname. Okay, I have a job up here this morning, and I hope y'all don't wear out, because as the time is, I usually take about 9.5 hours. Those of you who have been to Pompano Beach or any of the Mid-America seminars with Joe and Charlie and I. Oh, thank you. I'll get up on this bar stool here in a minute. I'll feel real comfortable. Those that have been to seminars where we do the big book and the 12 and 12, it takes about 9.5 hours for me to go, because when I do the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I use the directions that are in the book. These books were given to us, our big book and this 12 and 12, as guidelines and directions. And I can do the 12 steps off the top of my head in 30 minutes. I can do them in an hour by just telling you, okay, this is what I did. But there's so many out there that this is not going to help. They're new people. They're people that have been around a long time that have stayed sober on the fellowship, and it's been all right for a while. But in the long run, we're told that this won't get it done. These directions are important to us. I have not found it absolutely necessary. I'll wait till I get tired. I haven't found it absolutely necessary to take a drink of alcohol since June the 19th, 1957. And I know there's some of you young people that are sitting down there saying, my God, she's been sober longer than I've been born. That's okay for you to sit down there and say that, hon, but don't come up here and tell me that. I am from Spring, Texas. I'm a native Texan. And so I know there's nobody down here that really ponders about what the use of the word y'all, because I'm going to be using it. It's normal for me. And all it is the plural for all y'all. It's for our New Yorkers' sake, those that... In the foreword to the 12 and 12, I ask that it be put on the flyer that you bring your 12 and 12, because that's what we're going to go by, directions. And in the foreword, it tells us here in the second paragraph that this book deals with the 12 steps in the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It presents an explicit view of the principles by which AA's members recover and by which their society functions. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Dear God, that's what I wanted when I got here. I was scattered in so many pieces. And this book promises us that we can be usefully whole. Our big book promises us that. A lot of people avoid the 12 and 12 because they think that it's sort of being not very faithful to the big book, that in some way it's in competition with the big book. And I think if you really look at it, you're going to find that no, it complements the big book. In no way am I saying that, you know, our 12 steps aren't spelled out for us beautifully in our big book. But we see that Bill, after the big book was published, over the next 12, 13 years, Bill got letters. He got lots of letters. He got lots of phone calls asking, Bill, what did you mean when you say in the big books such and so? What did you mean by that? Or can you make this a little bit plainer? And Bill knew that he needed to have a supplementary text. I'm a teacher by profession, taught school for 37 years. And a lot of people, you know, whisper around that, my God, that's why she drank. But, and I know that in many of the courses that I taught throughout those years, I would have a basic text for the students, and I'd have a supplementary text, you remember those, that went into further detail of what the text had told them. So I would tell them in the beginning, say if it was United States history, all right, this is the basic text over here. This is our supplementary text. We're going to know both of these books before this year's over with. So this is a complement, actually, too. And if we go over on page 17, it says the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, became the basic text of the fellowship, and it still is. This present volume proposes to broaden and deepen the understanding of the 12 steps as first written in the earlier works. See, this was published approximately 14 years after the big book. So Bill's telling us here that it broadens and deepens the understanding of the 12 steps. The last paragraph says, it's hoped that this volume will afford all who read it a close-up view of the principles and forces which has made Alcoholics Anonymous what it is. In AA Comes of Age, he tells us a little bit more about why they put together the 12 and 12. On page 219 of AA Comes of Age, it says, one more noteworthy event marked this quiet period of quiet. And that was that first 12 to 13 years. The publication of AA's 12 Steps and 12 Traditions in 1953. This small volume is strictly a textbook which explains AA's 24 basic principles and their application in detail and with great care. So we have a base for what we're going to do this morning and this afternoon of taking this textbook and seeing how it can broaden and deepen the understanding of the principles that we talk about in step 12 when we say practice these principles in all of our affairs. And we're going to dig out the basic principles. A beautiful man in the Akron area named Paul Kay, and I know a lot of you know him. We became very good friends, and he passed on to me a list of the principles that he had put together on his own. These are not in New York. They're not written in stone anyplace. I use them because Paul said, as I went over and over these steps, these are the principles that I dug out for each step that they're talking about in step 12 when they tell us to use them in all of our affairs. And many people have asked at meetings, you know, we use these principles. Where are the list of the principles? There is no list. But each step gives us a springboard to use that particular principle and words like it, words that mean the same thing, in all of our affairs. So I take this little unlawful list of principles, and they're only guidelines, so if you wish to write them down, that's fine. But be sure as you're going through your 12 and 12, and as you think about your steps, that if you have some you can add, delete mine and put them there, or delete Paul's. Because I've used these. They're so helpful when I'm working with a new gal. And of course, I aim a lot of my talk towards the women, because that's what I understand. I love you men, and our pain was exactly the same. We share through two things in this room this morning, and that's pain and loss of control of our lives. But all of our details are so different. Our backgrounds are so different. We're like those people on that great passenger ship that Bill tells us about in the big book. That we have a common ground, and we have that common pain. We have that common loss of control of our lives. But our details vary. And I naturally aim a few, so you men be patient. And it's not because I think women are so different. This has nothing to do with feminism or the woman's movement or anything else. It's just the basic difference. And I know you men are glad for the difference between men and women. All right, we'll go to step one. And the principle that we want to think about here that we might want to add to our lives, start adding it right here when we take that step one. When we're trying to help somebody go through the steps, this is where it's valuable to me. And I tell my gals, I say, okay, here's where we start on honesty. The basic principle of plain old honesty and acceptance of the facts of life. Acceptance of that life is going to twirl us around on a twig. And we have to be honest about all this twirling, or we're going to twirl off into the sunset. So let's consider our basic principle that we want to put into our lives and practice in all of our affairs is honesty and acceptance. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And this is the part that kept me. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1953. So see, if you haven't walked through the doors and been an immediate success, you have lots of company. There's a lot of us that had to make many a running start on this thing. But I'm firmly convinced that from that very first AA meeting I went to in Omaha, Nebraska, back in 53, that God took my hand. And even though I rejected everything that was said to me by the beautiful men that were trying to help me, not only in Omaha, but in Rantoul, Illinois, and in Seattle, Washington, and in Belleville, Illinois, and all sorts of places. I was married to a United States Air Force officer, a pilot, and we moved. And those men tried so hard, and I keep saying men for the simple fact that there weren't many women around in the 50s, and particularly because we were moving from place to place. Then if a woman did come along, it was about time for us to move on. Those men loved me sober. They put up with me. And how, I don't know, because I don't know why they didn't just kill me and tell God I died. But this was a stumbling block for me in that admitting I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. I was a periodic, as the majority of women are, not all, but the majority of women are periodic. Many of you men are periodic or spree drinkers. You could level along for a while. I could go 3, 4, 5 months. And then there it was. There was no defense against that first drink, because I didn't know that was the problem to start with. But as these 4 years chugged along and I heard these men over and over talk about unmanageability, I slowly begun to see that my life was not just unmanageable when I was drinking. That wasn't when I was dishonest, not all the time. I was not dishonest when I was stone cold sober. And lying was not natural to me. I had grown up in a very, very placid background. In Spring, Texas, it's a very small town. We don't even have our own village idiot. We just all take turns. My life hadn't been complicated. Later on, I tried to convince a psychologist that my life, you know, I had gotten into all these problems because I had such a boring childhood. And, of course, he wasn't buying that. He wanted all the details. So, of course, you know what I did. I gave him details. I made up all the junk that I thought should have happened in this childhood that didn't happen. So when I would stop and think about the lies, lying had become such a part of my being, such a part of my psyche, such a part of my personality, that I didn't just lie about my drinking. I would tell a lie, you know, almost to climb a tree and tell a lie when I could stand flat-footed on the ground and tell the truth. And why did I do that? To make myself feel better about the times in my life that were completely out of control because of drinking. And the feelings that drunkenness was taking away from me, the dignity of a woman. There's nothing more humiliating and hurtful and shameful than being a woman drunk. That doesn't take away from you men's pain, But you never see a cartoon about a woman drunk. When somebody starts to tell you about, you know, a drunk story, they'll say there were these two old drunks. And you immediately imagine two fellas hanging on that bar stool. It very seldom starts off, there were these two old broads hanging on a bar stool. Now see, that's not going to be a funny joke. We're the wives and we're the mothers of the world. And so there is nothing funny. And when we begin to lose that dignity of being women, of being wives and being mothers, being companions, then we have to start making ourselves feel better, don't we? And I know that a lot of you men, when you think back, and if you were spree drinkers, you realize that your life wasn't just unmanageable when you were drinking. And that's what our 12 and 12 is starting here to tell us. Not only... And when I start helping a gal to go through these steps, I want them to understand that and to think about it. That they weren't just bad eggs when they were drinking. That this deterioration started when the obsession had set in. And when that allergy was full blown and their body was saying, please, please don't put any more alcohol into me. I'm allergic to it. And it was begging them not to. But that obsession had already taken place. And I think Bill does such a beautiful job here of explaining this obsession in a human being way. Dr. Silkworth wrote us another letter in 1947. It was in the grapevine. And he reminded us to never, ever forget that we were human beings first. And that when we got alcohol physically out of our lives, the human beingness set in. That we weren't any different, Dr. Silkworth said, than the ordinary Joe walking down the street. Our troubles were coming from human being traits. And this is what Bill starts telling us here. He says, you know, who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It's truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence can remove it from us. That's a big pill to swallow. It was big for me. I thought, no way am I powerless. No. There's no way you fellows are going to sit here and tell me. I still have my man. I still have my profession. I have no big marital problems because my drinking per se was not causing the problem. The change in Willie was causing the problem. The drinking wasn't any big deal. There's a lot of you men been in the service, and service people drink a little bit. When you go to somebody's house, they don't offer you a glass of buttermilk. You go to the officers' club, and you go there for one reason, and that's to party. So the drinking wasn't all that out of the ordinary, just like it is with a lot of with the young people today. It's everywhere. Everywhere they go. They're even allowing it into the churches now, you know, when they have wedding receptions and all these things. That punch is not going to be pure as the driven snow or as pure as the church is. A lot of times the churches are allowing it there. We're living in a drinking world, and I was living in a drinking world back then. So the powerlessness, the word powerless, didn't really make any sense to me because I hadn't lost everything. These men that I would go into meetings with, they had lost wives and whole families and jobs, and everything that they had was gone. They had drunk up everything. And I could understand why they felt like they were powerless, and that they were ready to admit that they were powerless. But I would look at the material things that I had left. See, I didn't look in their eyes and see that pain and realize that my pain was becoming the same. I would hear them joke about all the various jams they had gotten into. And see, as a woman, I couldn't see anything funny about anything I had gotten into. And I could not see. The word subtly is used so many times in the big book and in the 12 and 12. And the subtlety of how this lying got to be a part of my nature. And it didn't just jump there. You know, there are three words in the English language. If you put them all in a paper sack, lying and rationalizing and excuse making, they're going to all fall out together when you turn it upside down. We start first by making excuses to ourselves. And we rationalize our behavior to ourselves. Not only our drunken behavior, but our behavior in between. And rationalizing and excuse making and lying mean the same thing. If I make an excuse to you today about something I did or didn't do that I should have done, if you turn me loose with that excuse, and if I don't check with it real quick, I'm going to end up telling you a lie. You know, if I'm late for an appointment with you and I go in instead of just saying, you know, gosh, dog, I just didn't start early enough. Try not to let that happen again. But sometimes, you know, we don't want to look bad in any way. And we go in and we say, oh, Lord, there was a wreck on the freeway. There was this 18-wheeler and it was crossways of the freeway. And I tried to get around the wreck and I took a detour. And I got lost off where I thought I knew I was going. And blah, blah, blah. And I'm turning into a liar. Because that's not what happened. I just didn't get started early enough. But I have to check myself. And to this day, I have to check myself. Because if I start rationalizing my behavior, if I start rationalizing by making excuses, that I'm going to end up lying. And this trait follows us, and it's one, this honesty has to become a part of my being. And I have to have enough guts to get in there and say, sorry I was late, but I just didn't get started in time. And then it's over, see? Because I can create unmanageability with that excuse I just gave you. Because, see, we'll have our lunch or whatever our appointment was about, and then I get in my car and I start driving home, and what do? I start worrying about whether that imaginary wreck is going, you know, that it's not going to be on the 6 o'clock news. And I wonder what she's going to think when this horrible wreck isn't described in the 6 o'clock news. And what do? The old guilt sets in. And then the irritability sets in. And it becomes a chain reaction. So I must at all times try to be as honest as I possibly can. And every once in a while, Minnie Mouse gets loose, you know, and I'll get into one of these big rationalizing and excuse-making things. But thank God I have this principle that I started out with in this step one to come to my aid. Bill tells us in that first paragraph that we just read, you know, he said, who cares to admit complete defeat? He didn't say alcoholics can't admit defeat. He said, who cares? You know, all of us, when we were little fellas, and if we've raised kids of our own, we do the same thing that was done to us. When we were just little old bitty tykes, and we tried to learn something new. Say we're trying to learn tire shoes. And man, the first time we got down there, and we got them in 14 different knots. What'd Mama say to us? Here, honey, I'll get it untangled for you, and you try again. In every new thing that we tried to learn, our parents didn't say to us, you know, when they saw the tangled shoelaces, well, you'll never be able to tie your shoes, so I'll just go ahead and tie them for you, you know, for the rest of your life. Try again. What about you men when you were out there trying to teach your kids how to catch a baseball? And his little old hands were out to here, and you'd go and adjust his hands and say, no, make a little pocket here for that baseball to go into. And he'd drop it, and what'd you say? Try again. He'd swing that baseball bat and miss that ball that far. You didn't say, well, son, let's go on in the house because you never will learn how to play baseball. No, you said, try again. That's what Bill's telling us here. We were trained, and we train our own children that way. Try again. You can do it. You can do it. What kind of humans would we be? God didn't put us here to let an obstacle, you know, come up in our lives and we just say, well, that's it. I won't try that anymore. No, that's not the human being thing to do. And that's to keep on giving it a bloody go. So it wasn't so unusual that we kept on with our drinking and kept trying different ways. Lying to ourselves all along the way with excuses and rationalizing that if we just did it different, if the circumstances... Bill takes up that great big page in the big book telling us of all the different things that... or some of the different things that we tried, and we could add to his list on and on and on and make up a book of our own. When he tells us about Jim putting the whiskey in his milk. See, Jim was just... he was just trying to find some way to get that alcohol into him, which is not the least bit out of the ordinary. Because what Jim was trying to do was overcome an obstacle put in his path. If I do it a little bit different. So if you're new, and particularly I watch myself when I'm working with new people, and they're not, you know, they're just not real happy about being powerless. And especially with the real high bottom drunks. You know, we have a lot of people coming in now to us because we're getting so dignified. Sometimes I don't even recognize my own disease, but it's sort of getting to be a status symbol to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we have to work sort of hard down in the Houston area to keep out the social climbers. But we get people that, you know, have just barely touched, and Bill touches on that in this 12 and 12. He says the potential alcoholic. And man, when you get a hold of one of those, you have to be real understanding about this word powerless and the fact that they want to reject it. They still have homes. They still have spouses. They still have mates, the whatever. They still have all the material things in their life. They haven't lost any of that. And I have to be patient by knowing that their rejection over powerlessness is natural and normal, because Bill tells us here. At the bottom of the page on 21 there, it says, we know that little good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he has first accepted his devastating weakness and all of its consequences. That's what it's talking about there. The unmanageability in between the drinking. the change that takes place in most of us. A very wise man told me one time, he said, "You know, Willie, it's true. Many, many people, the personality of the person brings on the alcoholism. But in just as many cases, the alcoholism brings on the personality." And that's so true. The drinking span of a woman is approximately 6 to 7 years. You men can get by 15 to 20. And sometimes the subtlety of what is happening to us is absolutely baffling. And we don't see this change in us deep down inside, in our very personalities, in our character, in our psyche, that has to change. And he emphasizes here in all of its consequences, not just the drunkenness. He wants us to understand that. He said, unless he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. There's a promise. There are a lot of promises in this little 12 and 12. And there's one of them. He said, you know, until we so humble ourselves that we are powerless over alcohol, then our sobriety, if any, is going to be precarious. I don't want mine precarious. I want mine planted firmly on the ground. Of real, another promise coming up here, of real happiness, he will find none at all. I want the happiness. There's one thing I've never been able to get off my inventory, and that's greed. Where this program is concerned, I want it all. I want all of it. I don't want just the sobriety. I want that happiness. I want that peace in the storm. I want all of it. This program is so magnificent and so big. The facets of it, we all can look at our own lives and see what it's doing for us, whether we've been sober 15 minutes or 100 years. It doesn't... The caliber of what we can become, that's what we're shooting at. And it tells me here that of real happiness, I'm not going to find any at all until I admit that powerlessness. Proved beyond doubt by an immense experience, this is one of the facts of AA life. The principle that we shall find no enduring strength until we first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our society has sprung and flowered. This admission of powerlessness, that we no longer have any control and there's no way for us to get it. There's no gimmick we can use. And to look at that unmanageability. It says, when first challenged to admit defeat, most of us revolted. There's our human being that's in us, isn't it? We had approached AA expecting to be taught self-confidence. Then we had been told that so far as alcohol is concerned, self-confidence was no good whatever. In fact, it was a total liability. I think sometime when we get into this powerlessness, it makes us realize that we once again have to go sort of against something that we've always been taught. And that's the emphasis on you can do it. I know you can do it. What is that? That's self-confidence. Our parents told us it was necessary. Our coaches in school told us it was necessary. Our teachers told us it was necessary. Have a little faith in yourself. Come on. You can do this. And that's a building of the self-confidence. Something that we want to develop in ourselves. But where alcohol is concerned, it's a total liability, he tells us here. That we can't keep going with this. There's some way I can do this. Because we're fighting an allergy of the body that's there. And I've never seen an allergy that is inside the body in the chemical makeup the way Dr. Silkworth tells us that our allergy to alcohol is reverse itself. Diabetes doesn't. I'm allergic to penicillin. I found that out in the 40s when penicillin was real new. I took it about 3 times before that allergy really became full-blown. And that explains to me so much the fact that I had a lot of good years of drinking. A lot of good years, just like a lot of y'all had down there. But when I started putting alcohol into my system on a regular basis, first time my reaction to penicillin wasn't all that bad. The second time I took it, the doctors didn't know all that much about it, so the little rash that I had, no big deal. The third time they gave me penicillin, I quit breathing. And do you know I haven't had any penicillin since? That allergy grew, and when it was full blown, my body said, uh-uh. Do not put any of that stuff in me again, and I haven't. And the alcohol is the same way. The allergy is there. And I would be just as crazy to pick up a drink now and try to think that this body in 37 years has changed except just gotten older. To think that that allergy is gone, I won't try it with penicillin. I don't care how sick I get. I'm always going to tell that doctor, don't give me any penicillin. I can be just that practical and cautious about the allergy that I have in my body. I can't be self-confident that after all this time that Willie's in, you know, her life's pretty well going along here and this has become a part of my life that, no reason why after all these years, surely I'm not allergic to alcohol. That's as crazy as the penicillin rationalization. Crazy. Our sponsors declared that we were the victims of a mental obsession so subtly, there's our word, powerful that no amount of human will power could break it. There was, they said, no such thing as the personal conquest of this compulsion by the unaided will. Relentlessly deepening our dilemma, our sponsors pointed out our increasing sensitivity to alcohol. An allergy, they called it. The tyrant alcohol wielded a double-edged sword over us. First, we were smitten by an insane urge that condemned us to go on drinking, and then by an allergy of the body that ensured we would ultimately destroy ourselves in the process. Those are the only two things I have to know. That obsession will come back very subtly if I don't watch it. And that's what all the one day at a time is all about. I can't just watch it when I'm here with you. I can't just watch it when I go to AA meetings. I can't just watch it when I'm helping somebody else. Uh-uh. Willie has to watch it 24 hours a day because that obsession is not going to hit me like a ton of bricks. It's going to come very slowly. And I'll let that obsession build if I leave these principles out of my daily living. If I get dishonest, then that obsession has a little bit of peephole in there, and it's going to start subtly creeping back in. Few indeed were those who, so assailed that ever won out through single-handed combat. It was a statistical fact that alcoholics almost never recovered on their own resources. And this has been true, apparently, ever since man has first crushed grapes. Now note there that it doesn't say that no one has ever quit drinking on their own resources. A lot of folks do on their own resources. But he used the word recovered there. Recovering from the damage that alcohol had done to me. And to keep that recovery as a daily part of my life. Because he does not say that no one can get, you know, can get sober. Almost any fool can get sober. We found that out because I was a fool for 4 years. I'd get sober and I'd stay sober a while, but see, the problem was I couldn't stay sober because that obsession was creeping all the time right there by me. And that allergy was already there. It's hard for me to leave a step. Y'all are going to find that out. And I hate, there's so many things in this 12 and 12 helping us on this first step. Over on page 23, it says, it's a tremendous satisfaction to record that in the following years, he's just been talking about the real low-bottom drunks. This has changed. Alcoholics who still had their health, their families, their jobs, and even two cars in the garage began to recognize their alcoholism. As this trend grew, they were joined by young people who were scarcely more than potential alcoholics. Just as the first time I took penicillin, there was only a rash on the back of my hands. I was not fully allergic at that time. They were spared that last 10 or 15 years of literal hell that the rest of us had gone through. Since step one requires an admission that our lives had become unmanageable, how could people such as these take this step? It was obviously necessary to raise the bottom the rest of us had hit to the point where it could hit them. This was one of the questions that Bill started to get. Look, Bill, I'm not completely, you know, my life is not completely unmanageable. They'd write him letters and say, I still have my home. The kids are still here. I still have my job. And this is why Bill went to great lengths to show us here that, yeah, we had to, that's why the stories were changed in the back of the original big book. They raised that bottom to accommodate those people that hadn't lost everything they had. By going back in our own drinking histories, we could show that years before we realized it, we were out of control. That our drinking even then was no mere habit, that it was indeed the beginning of a fatal progression. To the doubters, we could say, perhaps you're not an alcoholic after all. Why don't you try some more controlled drinking? Now, it doesn't say, won't you go out and drink some more and come back when, you know... No, that's not what he suggests. He suggests that we tell our people and that he's telling us. If you're really not sure, there's only one way to find out. You can't answer a bunch of questions written down on a sheet of paper and find out. He suggests some more controlled drinking. Go out and see if you can drink two drinks. No more, no less. No more, no less. Every day for 2 weeks. Is there anybody in this room that thinks they can do that except the Aldons? Even thinking about it sort of makes me a little sick for the fact that you tell me I can just have two drinks, or I tell myself, he's saying, you know, go ahead and try some controlled drinking. And that's what's meant by control. Name the number of drinks you're going to have, but be sure and take that first one. Whether it's one, two, three, or four, but take that first one every day. But set your limit at the beginning of that 2 weeks. And then never go beyond it. And even thinking about it is absurd. But you know, we have people that can do that. I lived for 48 years with a man that could do it. God, it was repulsive. But you know, when people come to us and they want to know why, you know, if they're alcoholic, we have a tendency, and many people have a tendency in AA, to tell them, well, did you do this or did you do that or did you have blackouts? Did you so? A whole bunch of questions. And our facilities that are trying to help us, God bless them. I went into one not too long ago and they had 6 pages of questions that the poor old alcoholic had to answer before he could be admitted, you know. And I thought to myself as I flipped, some of those questions were 3 parts, you know, that long. Paragraph questions. And I thought, oh, dear Lord. And I couldn't help but think about Wino Joe. We have a fellow down in Tyler, Texas, God bless him. He's gone now. But Wino beautiful man, and he helped a lot of alcoholics. And he got tired of all these questions, you know, that people kept making up to test to see whether you're alcoholic or not. So Wino made up his own set of questions. And I can tell some of you have heard them. I asked Wino before he died if I could use these, and he said, sure. And, of course, as I go along, I've, you know, couldn't help but woman-like add a few of my own. But Wino started out, have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? Have you ever been arrested while in jail? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving it? Have you ever waited in line behind parked cars? Have you ever been married to the same woman twice and didn't remember either time? Have you ever become spiritually inspired by a mildew stain on a shower curtain? Have you ever called an ex-friend at 3 a.m. in December to ask just exactly what they meant by what they said at the July the 4th picnic? Now, see, our identity is a little bit better on these. The idiocy, the craziness, the insanity. These make more sense to us than, you know, did their boss look at you funny when you got to work last week and some of the questions that they made up. But Bill tells us there's a good way to find out if you're alcoholic. And for most of us that are, even the mere thought of controlled drinking makes us ill. Because deep inside we know that's over. Okay, at the end of step one there he says, under the lash of alcoholism we are driven to AA. And there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. Then and only then do we become as open-minded to conviction and willing to listen as the dying can be. We stand ready to do anything which will lift the merciless obsession from us. Honesty. That's what we're to get from step one. And start practicing in all of our affairs. On our step two, our beautiful promise there is hope. I talked about hope last night. Dear God, if we ever needed hope, we need it now. As a part of our daily lives, because all we have to do is turn on the television and read a newspaper and see what's going on in the world today, and it gradually chips away at us, chips away, and I have to watch that it doesn't chip away my faith in man, and the ability to overcome obstacles. The pendulum swings in history of the human race. And yeah, we in some big trouble nowadays. But that hope that I planted there, that I try to carry in all of my affairs, is bedrock. And this is where we start in. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Came to believe that. This little book helps me an awful lot in working with other people too. And says the moment they read step two, most AA newcomers are confronted with a dilemma, sometimes a serious one. How often have we heard them cry out, look, what you people have done to us. You have convinced us that we are alcoholics, that our lives are unmanageable. Having reduced us to a state of absolute helplessness, you now declare that none but a higher power can remove our obsession. Some of us won't believe in God, others can't, and still others who do believe that God exists have no faith whatever that He will perform this miracle. Yes, you've got us over a barrel, all right, but where do we go from here? He says, let's look first at the case of the one who says he won't believe, that belligerent one. It goes on to describe that one that's so belligerent and so angry with God that says, oh, do not, what's God done for me? He's taken away my home, he's taken away this, and he's taken away that, because, see, I have to remember, they're still thinking on the surface. And that belligerent one, I have to be patient and say, honey, you don't have to believe in any particular kind of power. You can pick your own God. Didn't they make beautiful allowances for that belligerent one? Because there's a steel trap right there when you tell him, you don't have to believe, except in something bigger than you are. And you can give him the example of the fact that, you know, he doesn't have to believe in electricity when he flips that switch. You don't have to believe or understand electricity. You walk in a room and you flip the switch. Just to believe that that power is there that's bigger than you are. We can look out our windows this morning, look at that ocean out there. It's bigger than we are. And there's no way that human beings can control that sucker out there. It's going to roll the way it wants to. Sometimes it rolls low and sometimes it rolls real high, doesn't it? There's so many things I tell them, and that those men told me, Willie, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you have no control over. Something is controlling it. Just think about that something that controls all of the things that we can't explain. And it planted a seed. They didn't beat me over the head and say, now, this is the way you have to believe. See, they had already tried that in Alcoholics Anonymous, our founders, and it didn't work. When they were told, people that came to them, you've got to have this vision that I had. You've got to have this God that I have. They struck out. So they decided, okay, there is an easier, softer way here to go about this. We can tell them they don't have to believe in a God that they can even explain to anybody. I can't explain God, my God, to anybody. When I got here, this was a real stumbling block to me, because there was only one church in Spring, Texas. When I was growing up, that was the German Lutheran Church. We went through 2 long years of catechism studying. Then on Palm Sunday, we got up before the congregation and we were asked a certain set of questions. And if we couldn't answer those questions, we couldn't join the church. We had to go back and study some more. So I found, see, that I knew a lot about God, about Him. But it took Alcoholics Anonymous to teach me to know God. And there's a world of difference in that. To really know and be able to feel this presence at all times of this thing that's controlling a lot of things that I cannot, no man can control. And I begun to be able to buy that. Because I kept telling them, I've had a strict religious upbringing, and it's not doing me a bit of good. I just pray and pray and pray and pray to this God, the very strict God that I understood, or that I didn't understand, but that I had been taught about, and I knew a lot about. But to really know and to be able to feel Him deep inside here, where it counted, I couldn't do that. So I have to remember that I have to be patient too. And they gave a good set of guidelines. This paragraph goes on to say, I know, well, says the newcomer, I know you're telling me the truth. It's no doubt a fact that AA is full of people who once believed as I do. But just how, in these circumstances, does a fella take it easy? That's what I want to know. That belligerent one. You know, you tell me to take it easy and I don't have a job. My wife left me. She took my kids. You tell me to take it easy. We can get a little bit belligerent, can't we? And we can say, I don't want to listen to you. You're telling me something that doesn't make any sense to me. That agrees the sponsor is a very good question indeed. I think I can tell you exactly how to relax. You won't have to work at it very hard either. Listen, if you will, to three statements. These three statements. First, Alcoholics Anonymous does not demand that you believe anything. Let that soak in for a minute. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't demand that you believe in anything. All of its 12 steps are but suggestions. Second, to get sober and stay sober, you don't have to swallow all of step 2 right now. See, that's what they tried in the beginning to get people to do. Get on their knees and do it right now. But then they found that this didn't work. And to assure a person that this, you don't have to take all of it immediately. It says, looking back, I find that I took it piecemeal myself. Third, all you really need is a truly open mind. Just resign from the debating society and quit bothering yourself with such deep questions as to whether it was the hen or the egg that came first. Again, I say, all you need is an open mind. So our little 12 and 12 is making it clear to us there that we don't have to come to believe in that power, just, and that's it. It's not going to be that simple. We came to believe. When I came here yesterday, I started in Houston and I got on the airplane and I came here. But I didn't take just one giant leap and get here, did I? That's what it says. Came to believe that a power, if I can just get that far, that somewhere, somehow, there's this power. And in step 2, they take us through. On page 29, it says down here, we come to another kind of problem, the intellectually self-sufficient man or woman. You know, we so many times we think we have these keen, brilliant minds, that the alcoholic has a very keen and brilliant mind. Of course, the funny thing about it is, alcoholics are usually the only one that think that. That we had this keen, brilliant mind. It was educated and it was honed and it was well cared for. To these, many AAs can say, yeah, we were like you. Far too smart for our own good. We love to have people call us precocious. We used our education to blow ourselves up into prideful balloons, though we were careful to hide this from others. Secretly, we felt that we could float above the rest of the folks on our brain power alone. How many of us thought I'm smart enough to get myself out of this. I'm smart enough to do this by myself. I don't need these bunch of people, and I don't need any kind of power floating around. I can do this. Shoot, I got through college. I had a master's degree. I'd written a thesis. I thought, oh, man, I can think my way out of this. Wrong. Scientific progress told us that there was nothing man couldn't do. Knowledge was all powerful. Intellect could conquer nature. Since we were brighter than most folks, so we thought, the spoils of victory would be ours for the taking. The God of intellect displaced the God of our fathers. But again, John Barleycorn had other ideas. See, every time I thought, shoot, I got this thing whipped. I've been sober 2 or 3 months. I got it made in the shade. I don't have to do all that Mickey Mouse stuff that they do. I'd go out and drink. Who took care of all that? Who took care of that degree and that master's and all this stuff? Out the window it went. And if you do this enough times, you know, even the intellectuals finally get it. Even the old dummies finally get it. The in-betweenies finally get it. That no, we're not going to think ourselves out of this. We who had won so handsomely in a walk turned into all-time losers. We saw that we had to reconsider or die. We found many in AA who once thought as we did. They helped us to get down to our right size. By their example, they showed us that humility and intellect could be compatible, provided we placed humility first. When we began to do that, we received the gift of faith, a faith that works. This faith is for you too. Beautiful promise.